AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
I'm very happy to welcome back my friend Rob Wasinger to Church and Culture. I've known Rob quite a long time. When I first came to Washington, he was the chief of staff and presidential campaign manager to U.S. Senator Sam Brownback. He knows the Congress very well, having worked in the Senate for many, many years. He ran for Congress himself in Kansas. Then he worked for the Trump campaign, Trump-Pence campaign. He oversaw the war room, election day operations, and then went on to be part of the transition team for a short time. And he is now the senior vice president of McGuire Woods Consulting and advisor to the Trump Super PAC America First policies. Rob, welcome.
Thank you, Gil. It's good to be on with you again, and looking forward to spending some time with you and your listeners.
Well, what I want my listeners to know is that it's very hard to introduce you because you've done so many different things and in politics and in the culture. You're a Catholic guy, great wife Megan, lots of kids, but you're also very much an insider in Washington and can explain that world as much as you're allowed to our listeners. And so let's start off right here. On the inside of the D.C. Heart of darkness, as I call it, how are people generally feeling about the upcoming midterms elections?
Well, I think, that question has had different answers over the past couple of months. I think you had initially a lot of enthusiasm on the Democrat side with what they called a blue wave that would occur. And then I think since then, the Democrats have made some very, very large strategic mistakes. And one was attacking our Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, which I think went sideways on the Democrats in a big way. And what you saw in polling at the time was voter intensity for Democrats outstripped Republicans by 12, 13 percentage points. And that Kavanaugh demonstration protest that the Democrats manufactured out of whole cloth brought our intensity out to be equal to theirs. So our voters are now as mobilized and as active and as interested in these midterms as the Democrats. And I think our side understands what's at stake more with the Supreme Court than the left does. So in answer to your question, I think things have improved considerably over the past month. We've seen a lot of undecided voters, suburban moms, kind of coming home to their party. So you have tightening of polls in a lot of races that people thought would be easy. I also say one other interesting thing is after that Kavanaugh, Heidi Heitkamp, everybody thought, she had a tough race, but as soon as that Kavanaugh show was over with, her political obituary was written that very day. Because of her vote, and then tightening up of races in Missouri, in Indiana, Florida, of course, is tight. We're talking, Arizona and Nevada now, places where we thought we'd have problems. At least for the Senate races, we're in much stronger position than we were before. And I think, the House side, it just depends on how much of that enthusiasm carries over to our House candidates. But there is a path to victory on the House side, too. And Democrats are also, this is interesting, they're walking back all of their claims of this great blue tsunami sweeping over the House and the Senate. They're not talking like that anymore. And nobody, at least I haven't met anybody, that thinks the Democrats have even a ghost of a chance of taking the Senate. And the House will be a lot tighter, obviously. But
how many seats would the Democrats need to take to control the House?
Well, most of the model, they have to get to 220. So they've got to win in all those suburban districts that, you know, that we did well in last election cycle. So that's where the key in our path to victory is we have to be competitive in those places. And some of them are obviously difficult, but.
Well, what is the number of Democrat seats right now?
Oh, what is it? It's 2, I'm sorry, I don't know the exact number, 216, 217, somewhere in there?
My understanding is that during midterm elections of any administration, there's an average of around 24 seats lost to the opposition party. And I've heard it said that Republicans cannot afford to lose more than 24 seats or they lose control of the House. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's about right. Those are about the numbers.
So,
Go
ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Jill. Sorry. Well, one other thing is Republicans, we had a problem with kind of a lot of, some of the weaker Republican colleagues wanting to retire because they thought that, you know, being in the midterm ballot, they would lose their seats. And so we actually made our position worse through the sheer number of retirements that we had on the Republican side, which is unusually high. And a lot of those races we could have won, like Frelinghausen in New Jersey, Lobianco in New Jersey, I think Jenkins in Kansas, Royce. You know, Ice always has a tough race in San Diego, but he's always competitive and seems to pull it out. So we have a lot of races that we have to be competitive in that we probably wouldn't have had to be. So, in other words, so some of this problem is of our own creation just with some of these guys retiring too soon. But even with all of that said, Republicans are coming home, they're motivated, and there is a really good chance that we can maintain the House. I mean, we're going to lose seats. I don't think anybody debates that. But I don't think we're going to hemorrhage the way that the left fought and claimed that we would, you know, a month ago.
What do you make of this new group of Democrat candidates who are espousing pure socialism? Is that something that's going to be part of the Democratic Party in years to come?
Oh, I think so. I think it's great. I think it's an amazing thing because the Democrats are in an identity crisis of epic proportions. They don't know what they believe. They don't know why they believe it. And so that kind of Young Turk movement on the Democrat side is putting that their ideas and their platform out. Yeah, I mean, Democrats have represented creeping socialism for, you know, since the New Deal. And they're just getting more and more aggressive with it. And I think now that we're calling them socialists, we're just more honest about the branding of the Democrat Party. So absolutely, I think it is a part of their platform. It's who they really are. They're kind of a loosely held coalition of special interest groups that want to change the very face of the country.
How successful do you think these kinds of candidates can be outside of places like Queens or Berkeley or Ann Arbor? I mean, do they have any appeal outside of these pockets of far left-wing liberals?
I don't think so. Newt Gingrich had a theory which I really do subscribe to back during the Republican Revolution, the 104th Congress, which is that if Republicans win suburban districts and the Democrats are basically chased into the urban core, a lot of cases a very rotting urban core, that their leadership has to represent that urban core, and that just creates more of a disconnect with the American people. Nancy Pelosi as the Speaker of the House, I mean, she's not just a leftist. She's an extremist. And I think the rest of America, like, looks at what she says and just scratches their head. So, no.
She's supposed to be a Catholic senator. I mean, congresswoman.
Yeah.
Is she Catholic?
I mean, she doesn't seem very Catholic to me, but I'm not the best Catholic either.
I keep seeing her honored at very Catholic institutions around the country, and she's actually revered by the Catholic left in this country.
I think Well, that's true. I mean, she's definitely honored at a lot of those things. I think that's probably also reflective of, you know, I guess some people in the hierarchy that maybe aren't on message with the teachings of the Catholic Church. Certainly as a member of Congress, she doesn't represent Catholic values at all. I can't think of one thing that she's done over her whole career that has really been reflective of Catholic doctrine on anything.
Well, let me ask you this. If the Democrats are in identity crisis, and if I'm right in saying that most of the bishops in this country, and certainly the USCCB, have directly or indirectly sought to support or to encourage Catholic support for the Democratic Party, does that mean they're in a disconnect with the American people as well?
Look, when it comes to the USCCB, I think they've been out of touch not only with the Catholic Church, but with the American people for a very, very long time. If you look at the agenda that they pushed on the Hill, and I've seen it at work. The way
tell our listeners about that. How does it work? If you used to be in Senator Brownback's office, tell our listeners how it works when the USCC representatives come over to Congress.
Oh, they'll come. We'll get a bishop. Maybe we'll get a cleric. Maybe we'll get a sister, a nun, a brother. And they will come and they will lobby the Hill for Democrat initiatives. I had two nuns come and lobby the office on then-Senator Ted Kennedy's Patient Bill of Rights, which supported abortion on demand, which did not reflect Catholic teaching or social values, and they were lobbying for passage of it. When it comes to immigration, they're open borders, and they hit the Hill and lobby for open borders and amnesty. I can tell you this, the USCCB does not represent the American people, but even worse, they don't represent the Catholic Church. That place needs to be padlocked and shut down.
So when you say lobby, are you saying they come into and ask for appointments with members of Congress? And do they meet with members of Congress, or do they meet with staff? Just how does that work?
Yeah, depending on the level of person that you have visiting, so if you have a bishop or a cardinal, you'll probably get somebody that comes in and gets a meeting with the member themselves. And then they speak in these, you know, soft tones of how many people they represent, and then they use some of the good things that the church does to justify some of the bad things they want to do. So, for example, on the healthcare issue, you'll have a bishop or a cleric come in and talk about all the Catholic hospitals that the church runs, which we all say is a good thing, right? And then they go into an advocacy program for some of these bad things that are tied up in the patient's bill of rights or other healthcare bills that the Democrats are pushing, mandatory coverage of things that Catholics find objectionable to. And it's really confusing, because when a senator or a congressman sees the bishop, sees the cleric, sees the pectoral cross, and then sees what they're advocating, they don't really have the wherewithal to question that, unless they're very, you know, devout and orthodox Catholics, faithful to the teaching. And so that creates a real problem just with, you know, the church's identity when it comes to lobbying for some of these legislative initiatives.
When you were in Congress, did you ever have anybody from USCCB come to you on a pro-life issue?
The pro-life office has done a good job. Now, I left the Hill years ago, but their advocacy was always thorough. It was in line with Catholic teaching. But let me also say, that is literally the only office at USCCB that I've worked with that seemed to be reflective of what the church means when it talks about the pro-life issue.
Well, that's good to hear. In my interaction back when I was working with President Bush, is they have a lobbying office, correct? They have a group of 10 or 12 employees who their job is to go to not just Congress, but I assume the state legislatures, and lobby for specific legislation. And they are, I mean, so this is actively going on every day, the distance from the USCCB to the Congress is, what, about 2 miles? About a 30-minute car ride?
Right.
And this is going on every day. Do you think, I mean, what do you think that USCCB is saying to members of Congress about the policies of the Trump administration?
Well, by the way, let me also just clarify one thing earlier. The pro-life office has its own, kind of what you're talking about, their own lobbying arm. So they're kind of separate from USCCB overall,
right,
is my understanding,
right,
in terms of the lobbying objectives. And they are very, very effective and very easy and good to work with. I think if you take the cue that you get from a lot of the clerics out there, I don't know. I haven't gotten any sense that they're supportive on immigration policies and priorities. I think that everybody's been very supportive of Kavanaugh, and at least on the pro-life side. And so those are good things. Like in terms of specific, you know, agenda items, I know they had some issues with the tax bill that probably weren't all that helpful for Republicans. So it just kind of depends on what the issue is. Where they're going to come down on it. But the USCCB writ large, again, separate from the pro-life office, is generally not a supportive force when it comes to advancing, and I won't even say Trump, I just say kind of Republican ideas of lower taxes, less government, less regulation, and, you know, kind of restoring freedom and all those values to the American people that have slowly been eroded since the New Deal.
I'm talking with Rob Wassinger, who is Senior Vice President at McGuire Woods Consulting in Washington, D.C. He's also advisor to the Trump Super PAC, American First Policies, and worked in the Trump campaign and in the transition. Rob, did you know when you were in working in the campaign and the transition, did you anticipate the level of hostility and daily hatred that the media would express toward President Trump?
No. And I don't think anybody. I don't think anybody really did. What's interesting is, I think, and I could be totally wrong on this, I think the left and Main Street media, there's only three institutions in this country that are so hostile to Trump. That's the academic world, mainstream media, and Hollywood, the entertainment industry. And those three organs of kind of the leftist, culture organization, if you will, I don't think they minded losing the presidency to somebody like Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio or, you know, some of the other candidates. What they can't handle and what they can't get their hands around is that they lost to Donald J. Trump. They lost to the one guy they just could not stomach losing to, because he's antithetical not only to the values of the left, he's antithetical to the establishment, to the uniparty. And Pat, my good friend Pat Buchanan always said that the Republican and the Democrats were two wings on the same bird of prey. And that's what Trump is against. He's against not only kind of those core Democrat values, but also kind of the establishment uniparty model that dominates politics in D.C. And so that's what I think gets them so bent out of shape. And he's actually doing it. He defunded UNRWA. He pulled us out of the Paris climate change. He's building the wall. He passed the largest tax cut in American history. Unemployment levels are the lowest they've been since 1969. GDP growth is humming along at a very healthy pace. And his deregulation, which they don't really talk about enough in my mind, the deregulation aside is a big driver to economic growth, just as businesses are freed up from all these unnecessary rules and regulations. So I think that's why they're so apoplectic. They can't they can't stomach him. If he came out and said the sky was blue, they'd have to object. The Democrats have gotten themselves into a position where they have to argue against the unemployment numbers, against the GDP growth. They have to defend birthright citizenship.
Or ignore it.
They can't let things go. They have to stand up against it. And the beauty of all that is it means that he continues to control the entire conversation. He is a master at controlling the conversation. And I think what you've seen this past week on the immigration, the wall, some of these issues is demonstration of that yet again.
Yeah, I mean, it particularly struck me regarding this caravan out of Honduras that it never sort of won the hearts of people, even those people who do watch CNN or do watch SNBC. It was reported and it was beaten hard, but it didn't get much traction, don't you agree?
No, I agree with you. I totally agree with you.
Do you think it was because it was just so outrageous to begin with?
It might be that, but it might also be that, I mean, I don't know if they're learning any of these lessons on these kind of debates or not, but I mean, they get burned on this. I mean, we've got an election coming up, and the American people are interested in their jobs, in a better economy, an improving economy. That's what they're interested in. And, you know, the caravan, the immigration, the birthright system, all that is, you know, is a distraction to the American people when it comes to voting. They don't want the caravan. They don't want the influx of immigration. They want to get America back to, you know, when it was great again. And we're well on the way.
And how are you are you measuring that economically? How else are you measuring that, Rob?
I would say the thing about economics is it's a social science. And so a lot of times, so you've got the economy, you've got GDP, you've got unemployment numbers, you have all that. And those are, you know, objective measures. But then you have the great growth in the stock market. You have a boost in consumer confidence. And what that is, that just measures how people are feeling. If they feel good about the economy, if they feel good about their lives, they're going to go out and spend money. They're going to invest. They're going to buy a new car. So those things, those are really feelings that people have about their country, about where they live in their neighborhood. And that is all very, very positive. You know, people are, you know, renovating their homes. They're making purchases to improve their lives. And that's really what I'm talking about. That is the America where people, you know, ingenuity, being proud of home ownership, the American dream. Those all play a big role in the overall feeling that people have.
Well, then let's come back to this hostility, or really hatred. You know, if you read any of the UK newspapers, The Guardian or the Observer, if you look at the front page of the New York Times or Washington Post on any day, you will find a series of predictably over-the-top attacks on the president or even on the first lady or on Junior, to the point where I don't even recognize how what they're saying connects with reality. I mean, seriously, where's the connection to the reality of what the president is doing and who he is?
Yeah. Well, that deal, I think that's a great observation. It's kind of funny. Sometimes I work and I watch the TV, and it's turned in, so I just see the headlines. And there's a total disconnect. The headlines are outrageous. And it's kind of like what we're discussing. The left just doesn't like this man and his policies and what he stands for. And they are committed to bring him down by any means necessary. That's why we have problems with, you know, the deep state trying to overrule some of his objectives just through the bureaucracy.
Remind our listeners what the deep state is. Remind them.
Yeah, so the deep state, that's kind of how we think of career civil servants, and not all career and civil servants, but usually more senior ranking career officials that stay in the administration despite whether it's a Republican or a Democrat administration. And a lot of these people are very powerful. They'll hold very high positions as principal assistants, principal deputy assistant secretaries, and they have a real impact on what happens. And there's a lot of war stories of our people fighting with these careers over very simple presidential objectives. And that battle wages on a daily basis with our good Schedule Cs and non-career senior executive service employees working to carry out the president's agenda, and then the careers, the deep state, trying to thwart them at every turn.
Well, you're not talking about Obama political appointees that have stayed over. You're talking about careerists.
Yeah, and there are a lot of Obama political appointees that burrowed in. And Schedule C is what you would refer to as kind of your general presidential appointment, political appointee. But there's other schedules that you can get, that politicals can get. And a lot of, as the administration changes, and this happens a lot more on the Democrat side, they stay, and they stay in senior roles, and they're still just as political an activist as they were in their regular roles.
This is certainly the case, as we've seen in the Justice Department and the FBI, correct?
Oh, yeah, I think that's, yeah, it's very clear. I mean, watching how they've operated in this phony Russian investigation, and the narrative that the deep state FBI has put out since the beginning of this administration has been very harmful. But I think the interesting thing with that, with the Department of Justice and the FBI, is that they have basically ended up just hurting their own credibility. I think the American people are seriously questioning, you know, what they're doing, because at least as I've watched some of the work with the FBI unfold over the past year or so, I've gotten a sense of people, career bureaucrats, like Strzok, others, where they feel like they're above the law. And in some of those text messages that we saw, especially Strzok and Page, they wanted to overturn the results of the election. And they were making plans and schemes and deals to overturn the results.
It's like a pulp novel. I'm talking with Rob Wasinger, a real knowledgeable guy, and we'll be back with him after this brief message.
My name is Father Matthias Thelen, and I want to invite you to the Encounter Conference, January 3rd through 5th, 2019, at the Seagate Center in Toledo, Ohio. This conference is going to be a time of spiritual refreshment, encouragement, empowerment, an impartation for more of the Holy Spirit for the sake of evangelization. And we're inviting evangelization leaders from all over the country. To learn more about this conference and to register, please visit Encounter2019.com. Encounter2019.com.
What are the doctrines Catholics believe, and why do we believe them? Hi, this is Peggy Stanton. Join me on Power from the Pews for more than a minute with the Catechism, as I quiz the experts, top theologians, philosophers, and catechists to share the truths about our Catholic faith. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net.
On our next Putting on the Mind of Christ program, we'll hear abortion survivor and pro-life attorney Rebecca Kiesling.
A pet peeve of mine in the pro-life movement is when people say, it's a child, not a choice. No, he or she is a child, not a choice. It is a very dehumanizing term. When I represented the mother in Michigan's frozen embryo case several years ago, the doctors testified at deposition that right from conception, one cell, the parent's DNA is gone, and they are literally male or female, and ascertainably so.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. Don't miss Rebecca Kiesling, Bishop Michael Burns, Dr. Monica Miller, and Dr. Alveda King, who all participated in the 2014 National Day of Remembrance for Aborted Children. We'll also hear Archbishop Alan Vigdoron on the next Putting on the Mind of Christ. It's heard every Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 7 on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
I'm back with Rob Wasinger, who is Senior Vice President in D.C. of McGuire Woods Consulting. He's an advisor to the Trump Super PAC and worked in the Trump-Pence campaign and in the transition. Rob, you mentioned earlier in the first half about the fake Russia investigation. Is there any way to describe how why it's fake in a simple way for our listeners?
Yeah, I served on the campaign as director of Senate and gubernatorial affairs as one of the 138 paid staffers, and we ran a very efficient, lean operation. I think Hillary Clinton had over 800 staffers. And I would say, not to discredit anything, but I would say we weren't big enough to collude. Just because we all worked so hard just to get the message out, coordinate surrogates, that we were running around like crazy. And there was nobody, and there was never any sense that I got that anybody was colluding with the Russians. It was like this whole idea that there was collusion with the Russians came up, you know, well after the campaign. It was part of the left's, you know, what we talked about earlier, that they want to bring this president down by any means necessary. And this Russia, this phony Russia investigation is just one of their avenues to try and do that. But I think the American people have seen that after, you know, coming up on 2 years of an investigation, what do we have? I mean, we have old charges from years and years ago against Paul Manafort and Rick Gates. We don't have any smoking gun of anything. The only people that were clearly colluding with foreign powers and outside influences were the Clinton campaign and the dossier that they put together and then pushed around through their media buddies. So it's ridiculous. We won the election, and they're trying to cast doubt on that. But I think the American people see through it. You know, an interesting story, really quick, deal. I did some of the monitoring for Pennsylvania Trump Tower for Election Day. And for one of our precincts, probably about 11 o'clock in the morning, we got a call that one of our voters had went in to vote for Trump, and the machine recorded it as having voted for Hillary. So we deployed and we got people there. We ended up impounding, or officials impounded, four machines where if you voted for Hillary Clinton, Hillary got the vote. If you voted for Donald Trump, Hillary got the vote. And funny, I never heard the reverse happening where it would default to Trump. So when it comes to, influencing the election, when it comes to voter fraud, when it comes to multiple registrations and votes by individuals, that's a Democrat phenomenon. Republicans don't play that way. We play fair. I think, in fact, in Pennsylvania, you could probably cut 2% off the totals and just count that up to voter fraud.
Do you think that will continue to happen, both in the midterms and in the next presidential?
I think it's probably going to get worse because, again, if you listen to the media, they're using strong language. They're saying, you know, by any means necessary, we're not going to sit down. We get Maxine Waters out there encouraging people to harass Trump supporters in public places. She says, tell them they're not welcome. That's a quote from Maxine Waters about how people should treat people that voted for somebody that maybe they don't like. And, you know, last election cycle, there was a lot of violence in the streets, not from Trump supporters, but from Antifa and the left, you know, causing riots and chaos. That's a leftist phenomenon. Republicans aren't like that. I do think it's going to continue, and I think they're thinking of ways to even accelerate it and make it worse.
Going back to the Russian investigation, do you think that Manafort and Flynn just got caught in the middle and that they are just victims of a fishing expedition?
Yeah, I'd say I would put it a little differently. I think they're political prisoners. We're yet to hear anything that any of those three individuals did on the campaign to get Russians or anybody else to influence the election in a way that's illegal, right? What you've got is, for Flynn especially, he didn't do anything wrong. He's accused of lying to the FBI, right? So they're investigating him, and he lied to them. So that's after the fact. That's after the election. Manafort and Gates, all their charges are from, you know, 10, 15 years ago. None of them.
And they're about their own financial schemes, right?
Yeah, they were financial schemes that had nothing to do with Trump. But again, it's the careerists, the FBI, trying to overturn the election, and they're trying to get leverage on Trump. They wanted to say, look, with all these charges, you're going to go to jail for however long you're going to go to jail, but give us the dirt on Trump, and we'll let you get a lesser sentence or let you off altogether. And the fact of the matter is, there's no dirt on Trump.
I think if Cohen had dirt on Trump, it would be out by now, don't you?
Oh, totally. If there was that, first of all, that the Mueller probe and all this stuff leaks like a sieve. If they had one shred of anything, it would have been out on day one. We're going into 2 years on this.
Explain to our listeners how leaking works. I mean, it's always alluded to. It's mentioned leak. What is the ethics of leaking, if there is such a thing?
Well, so the first thing, leaking is a process. And it's something that you have to be very careful about, and these career types are. And it's also something that you don't just do. It's something you develop. You develop a system of leaking. Let's take James Comey, for example, one of perhaps the most notorious leakers in federal government is James Comey, the disgraced former director of the FBI. He had a friend, a professor in New York, that he leaked all of his information to, and then they would show up in New York Times stories. So if you connect some of the FBI leaks with this professor, you can see a clear pattern that goes back years. But what that means is he had developed a process. He was comfortable with the process. Like, somebody that leaks for the first time is going to be nervous. Are they going to get caught? Will the person I'm leaking to betray anyone?
Now, is it illegal to leak?
It is illegal to leak.
And what kind of information is it illegal to leak?
Well, anything that's classified, which when we're talking about the FBI, pretty much is all classified, top secret or secured, compartmentalized information. It's illegal, and it carries very weighty federal sentences.
Is Comey going to face charges on this?
One would hope. I mean, he's admitted to leaking himself about taking notes, you know, on his own and then memorializing them and then changing the classification and then moving it to his friends. He's admitted to it. I would hope that he would, because it's outrageous and it needs to stop.
But is it an art form as well? I mean, it's done by everybody, not just Democrats.
Yeah, I would say a little bit it is an art form, because you have to develop that process so that you're comfortable in your chain of communication and who you're leaking to, that you won't get burned. And again, like I said, that process and that chain has been developed, you know, with numerous people, and I don't know who they all are, that leak information that's damaging to the president.
But you can leak.
Again,
you can leak on the understanding that the media is protected from ever disclosing its sources, correct?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I think gives confidence to some of these people that are, you know, betraying their own oaths of office when they leak. When a career or a bureaucrat or a federal employee leaks classified information, they are betraying their oath of office, and they should be prosecuted by the Department of Justice.
Has anybody recently been prosecuted for leaking?
No big names come to mind. I've heard that the DOJ is looking into it. But until we get some of these, I think a couple of high-profile prosecutions would probably take care of the problem altogether.
frankly, I'm surprised. Is the fact that no one has been subpoenaed on this or charged show the bias of the present Justice Department?
Yes, I think it does. I think it does. I Attorney General Jeff Sessions, great man, great career in the Senate, but I think he hasn't gotten the Department of Justice under control the way he really needed to. And I think it's really hurt the administration. Clearly it has through this Russian narrative that the left is continuing to propagate. So it does need to get under control, and, you know, it probably needs new leadership at this point.
Well, Rob, what keeps an attorney general from just going in and pardon my French, kicking ass and cleaning the thing up?
Well, honestly, there really isn't anything. The attorney general, like other cabinet-level secretaries, can set the agenda for the agency and should set the agenda for the agency and go out there and, as you say, start kicking ass.
Well, I guarantee you, I was waiting for it. Like you, I admired Senator Sessions, and I was very surprised at kind of the limp way he took over the Justice Department and especially even allowing this Russian investigation to get off the ground at all.
Yeah. No, he absolutely. And there was no need, in my view anyway, for him to recuse himself.
Explain to our listeners what that means.
So recusing just means that he takes himself out of the decision-making process and the stream of information relative to the Russian investigation. And as I remember, and I might be missing something, I remember the basis for his recusal was that as a senator, he met with the Russian ambassador once or twice, which as a senator is within his job and his purview. So, to me, that doesn't seem like he should recuse himself. And I'm pretty sure the president wanted an attorney general that was going to go out there, do the job of the attorney general, and not recuse himself from his own job, which is...
Is it too late to clean up the Justice Department?
I think with good leadership, strong leadership top-down, I think you can clean anything up. If you have good, strong, principled leadership at the top, willing to make the tough decisions to clean something up, you can do it.
So you think then that this Russian investigation has completely lost its traction with the American public?
Yeah, I don't. That's true. What little it did, I think, evaporated within the first 6 to 9 months, especially once people saw what they were doing and that the indictment had nothing to do with the election.
How can so many Democrats be promising impeachment of President Trump if they take control of the House? What exactly would they be impeaching him for?
Yeah, that's the Democrats living in la-la land. I have no idea what the impeachable offense is. I think the only thing they can impeach him for is they don't like him. Maybe they don't like his tweets. It's ridiculous. I mean, he hasn't done anything to deserve impeachment. But again, they're so angry that they lost to Donald Trump. Not that they lost, but they lost to him. And it drives them mad. Their hysteria has really, just watching the media and the academic institutions, it knows no boundaries. It knows no boundaries. I mean, especially when you get commentators in the media talking about violence against Trump supporters, when you have them talking about harassing Trump supporters at restaurants or when they're out in public.
Well, some have called for his assassination.
It's full-blown Trump derangement syndrome. I think it's a psychiatric condition at this point. Trump derangement syndrome, that's what they have. That's the diagnosis for the Democrats' problems.
You know, Rob, it's gotten so bad. Last weekend I was at a golf tournament, a national one, in Greensboro, and a very prominent golf writer, really one of the two or three most prominent golf writers, gave a speech, which was wonderful, But then at the very end, he got into Trump, and you could tell he just didn't like Trump at all. But he made the point that when Trump talked to him about his restoring of golf courses like Turnberry and other courses around the world, he asked Trump, you know, this is a time when people are closing golf courses. How are you able to do this? And he says, oh, we have Russian money. And he looked at the audience like, this proves that the Russian investigation is true. And I just sat there thinking, why does this have to invade a golf tournament? Tell me about it.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's what I mean. It's like they've got Trump on the brain and they can't get rid of it. Which is interesting because I think that, again, that derangement type syndrome where they're obsessed with him really plays to his advantage because he's able to control the conversation, the national conversation and debate. And that's not, you know, that's not a bad thing. If they're going to continue acting that way, I think they're going to continue marginalizing themselves from the American people.
So let's look ahead to post midterm election. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, we do lose the House, meaning we on the side of Republicans and pro life and all those principles you talked about earlier, conservative principles. What then happens to the functioning of the United States government and of the Trump administration in particular?
Well, I think, as we've discussed, I think if Democrats take control of the House, they're going to try and impeach the president. I also think you're going to see one investigation launched after another, all frivolous, all a waste of taxpayers' money, a waste of our time. But they'll launch investigation after investigation of some of the cabinet agencies and some of our political appointees in those agencies. And I think, as Democrats always do, I mean, what's the fallout from all that? I think the Democrats are going to overreach, they're going to overplay their hand, and they're going to be a very nice contrast to the president and to Republicans in 2020. If the Democrats win the House, we are totally assured of winning in 2020 President Trump's successful reelection, because the Democrats will overreach. You will see a mania that you have not seen before. And it's all going to be led by Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
What do you think Maxine Waters will be doing if they take the House?
She'll take on a leadership role. I think she's one of the, you know, the Young Turks, the socialist Democrats you were talking about before, they really like her. I think she'll be a spokesperson for the Democrat caucus on the House side. And again, I think that's good for Republicans because it shows the American people what we're really fighting against.
You know, if I was, if any Republican, you know, was talking the way she talks, I'd be deeply ashamed. I'd be embarrassed.
Oh, yeah.
It is. I mean, I can't give you all the adjectives that are in my mind to describe how she speaks publicly, but the one I will say it's repugnant.
Yeah, it's shameful. If a Republican talked the way she did, there would be pressure on that person to resign or step down, because it's so offensive, it's so over the top, it's repugnant, as you say. I totally agree.
I only say that because I once asked my sixth grade teacher, what was the worst thing I could call anybody or something? And he said repugnant. And so that has stuck with me ever since. If I ever call something repugnant, you better watch out.
You know, it's bad. It's really bad.
So, but what happens when the Congress is divided between a Republican Senate and a Democratic House? What actually gets through?
Well, let's start with the good news. The good news is we're not losing the Senate. That means, and what does that mean? That means more Supreme Court nominees. That means more justices that are constitutionalists on the court, on the bench. It means our ambassadors are getting confirmed. All of the president's appointees are getting confirmed. All that continues. Now, let me also just make maybe a small prediction. If we win re-election in 2020, which I believe we will, I think it is very, very possible we will have a 7-2 Supreme Court. Because I don't see a situation where some of the justices, particularly Breyer and RBG, are going to want to serve for another 6 years. And so that's going to get us into a very strong position. Imagine that. Since Roe v. Wade, what have conservatives and Republicans cared about the most? The Supreme Court. And it's something the Democrats don't even really pay attention to at this point. And we're going to get, we're at 5-4 now. We can get to 7-2. And that, to me, is amazing. Because we can start getting the country put back together, get the overreach from the court out of the system, and start fixing some of these problems that have been created by the leftist court that dominated our country for most of the last century. And that's exciting stuff. Now, the president has done a lot of his work through regulations, through unilateral action that he's been able to justify and defend in court, and all that continues too. That doesn't change. So the only thing it's going to have an impact on is more legislation, you know, another tax bill or funding issues, things like that. But then we're going to be in a position where there's still a strong hand to negotiate. So Democrats saying the House is bad, but we're still going to get our Supreme Court nominees if there are any more in the last few years. We're still going to get our judges. We're still going to get our nominees to the various agencies.
Because these things are confirmed by this. These things, our listeners may know, are confirmed by the Senate and don't have to have House approval.
Correct. Correct. That's absolutely right.
So, and if you're right, a post midterm Congress, if it was led by Pelosi, Maxine Waters, etc., would so overreach that it would push voters toward reelecting Donald Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, every time they've gotten the majority in the House, that's exactly what they've done, is they go too far.
Do you think there's any doubt Trump wants to be reelected?
Oh, yeah, he filed for re-election, I think, the day he was sworn into office. We already he's ready to go.
Well, I'll say for a guy that's over 70, he's got a lot of get up and go.
He has more energy than I have, Gio. He amazes me.
Well, yeah, and you know, I think Melania is such a great asset as First Lady.
Oh, yeah, she's terrific.
Have you ever had any dealings directly with her?
Yeah, with everybody on the trip. I did, we talked about my campaign work, Director of State Gubernatorial Affairs, but the last 2 months I did advance work for both of them. Great people. And Melania, the First Lady, has, you know, such grace, and she's perfect. She has good messaging. She's really the perfect First Lady.
Yeah, and of course they have to hammer on her too. They have to pick on her clothing, regardless of the context she's found in, whether it's, you know, being helpful with children in Africa or people who've undergone disaster by hurricane or flood. They still have to deconstruct whatever her clothing happened to mean to the left at that moment.
I know. Isn't it ridiculous? Again, that's that Trump derangement syndrome. They just can't let something be what it is. They're obsessed. They're absolutely obsessed.
Well, I'm going to let you go, Rob. I know you're out in California working hard, and I want to thank you once again for being on Church and Culture, but I want you to promise you'll come back and talk to us after the midterms.
Anytime, Gio. It's always fun to be with you, and I really enjoyed the time and the conversation today.
Thank you, Rob. Rob Wasinger. And to all of you listening, I'll be back on this day and this time next week.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
What is the purpose of receiving the Holy Eucharist? The Catholic Catechism tells us the principal reason for receiving the Eucharist is an intimate union with Jesus Christ, who is sacramentally and really present in the bread and the wine. Even if we receive just one of the species, we fully receive Christ. There are requirements and proper dispositions for receiving so great a sacrament. Our souls must be free of mortal sin. We are required to fast from food and drink for 1 hour before communion. We should wear appropriate clothing and assume the proper reverent gesture in order to reflect the proper solemnity, joy, and respect when Christ becomes our guest. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Ave Maria Radio.
Ave Maria Radio.
Light of the East. Weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, every Christian church has its own ancient and indigenous chant, which is sung by the faithful during liturgical services. This gives cantors a special place in Eastern Christian liturgy.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9. On 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
How do I handle difficult family members? When do I correct others? When do I hold my tongue? Too often we're late in realizing that we mishandle a situation, causing both resentment and frustration. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. And in my new book, Thinking Like Jesus, I tackle these questions and more. Check it out and more of my books at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax-deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
This is Life News Radio. I'm Jim Anderson. Alliance Defending Freedom announced over the weekend that California pro-life pregnancy support centers are officially free of government coercion. June's U.S. Supreme Court action told lower courts to scuttle the California law, compelling pro-life pregnancy centers to promote abortion. Just last Friday, 4 months later, the final court put California's law to an end. Two of the 17 states that pay for abortion are voting November 6th to drop that funding. Oregon abortion advocates, including Governor Kate Brown, say no abortion money would be an attack on health care. In the other state, West Virginia, the Susan B. Anthony List is working to get out the strong pro-life West Virginia vote. This is Life News Radio.
The view, the accurate view of the human person changes everything. The news you hear and see pertaining to the human person has the power to inform or misinform your opinions and what you do with the gift of life and what you allow your government to do. It's why we at this station offer news on the life.